What's up, people? I'm Erica, and this is Cocktails and Capitalism, a podcast that pairs crafted beverages with stories distilled from our capitalist hellscape. On April 15th, historic levels of coordinated direct action took place around the globe in solidarity with Palestine. Protesters carried out coordinated economic blockades in 82 cities and 19 countries. These actions directly targeted the global economy for its complicity in the genocide in Gaza, which continues as we record this episode. We're talking with who has been involved since the very beginning of the call for the 815 mobilization. How you doing?
I'm okay. I'm tired. How are you?
I bet. Oh my God. I'm doing pretty good. Happy to be here and happy to have a drink in hand. Really, really excited to connect with you and try to tell the story. So we've crafted a really, really special drink for this episode, the A15 Intifada Cocktail. It's a spicy, smoky riff on the Negroni, which is a favorite of We added jalapenos so that it's both a red drink with like a green accent, symbolizing the colors of Palestine. And yeah, it's an amazing drink. And I wanted to just say cheers to you and to all of the folks from A15.
Thank you. Excited.
It's so good. I love the smoky spicy combo. What a great idea. But yeah, I guess I'll just hand this over to you and let you kind of explain what A15 was, and we can just dive in.
Thank you. A15 began as a proposal to coordinate a multi-city economic blockade on April 15th. And that proposal received overwhelming commitments from around the world that grew day by day. The proposal stated that in each city, we would identify and blockade major choke points in the economy, focusing on points of production and circulation with the aim of causing the most economic impact. Taking, for instance, from the port shutdowns in solidarity with Palestine that took place over the winter in Oakland, California, in Melbourne, Australia, in Genoa, Italy. There was a sense in the streets as the unprecedented movement to free Palestine grew and grew, that escalation had become necessary, that symbolic actions were not enough, and a recognition that the global economy profits off of war and colonialism. And as Yemen was bombed to secure global trade, and billions of dollars were sent to the Zionist war machine, this recognition of the global economy's complicit in genocide brought people to the realization that it was necessary to directly disrupt and blockade economic logistical hubs and the flow of capital. The overwhelming support that A15 received, the proposal for the coordinated economic blockade on April 15th received, was also born out of a sort of a frustration with these symbolic actions and the leadership of NGOs and more formal organizations. However, it was not a sectarian call at all. Rather, it was modeling that each city could have autonomy in their choices of organizing, their choices of targets, their choices depending on their capacity and their local targets. So as each city organized autonomously, A15's coordination was based on some mutual solidarity agreements that we use to act in solidarity with each other in the face of attacks from the media, from the police, from the Zionist Project. And the agreements that we came to were that if one city were to face repression on A15, other cities would extend or expand or initiate blockades or other actions in response to the best of their abilities and capacity. Another solidarity agreement was that we would not attack each other or each other's actions on social media or to the press. And A15 held post-action debriefs as a place to raise principled critiques amongst those cities that participated in a constructive manner rather than publicly. And again, that was one of the solidarity agreements that all the cities adhered to ahead of time.
I wanted to quickly add that here our comrade is reading from the text of the solidarity agreements, which can be found on the A15 website, a15action.com.
Other solidarity agreements was that each city would be responsible for choosing and planning their own local actions, and that fellow organizers would not discourage or denounce each other's actions or plans, because the A15 coordination, solidarity meant affinity and not ownership. And the last agreement in the A15 coordination was that each city would keep each other safe internally and externally by not talking to the police, not coordinating with the police, not talking to them, period. And this proposal grew and grew and grew with more commitments day by day, especially after A15 went public. And on the day of, 82 cities in 19 countries across six continents participated in A15. So essentially, the only continent that didn't participate in the coordination was Antarctica. So it was a huge success historically in terms of, that I know of, I'm not sure if any sort of simultaneous coordinated action, especially one that is based on material targets rather than symbolic targets, has ever taken place on this scale.
Yeah, I mean, I was immediately struck by how historic this action was, how massive and widespread the different autonomous actions were, and just the scale of it was just remarkable. I really felt like this charted kind of a new path forward for people who are trying to confront state power. And yeah, I was just wondering if you had anything that you wanted to say about how this is new and remarkable.
Yeah, I think that the success of the proposal was partly, again, based on feeling that symbolic actions were not enough, that there was a need for collective risk-taking, and also that the solidarity agreements and the way in which each city was holding up the other cities and watching them and supporting their actions really gave way to this incredible geographical global spread of actions. You know, and it's hard. There was A15 also, you know, needed very, very quick translation into different languages, a lot of listening as well, and a lot of learning about other political cultures and other ways of doing things across the world. But it was interesting that so many people around the world understood that it's not just about targeting Israeli products or corporations that are invested in Israel. And it's not just about targeting, say, even the Zim ship, the Israeli ship, but that in fact, the global economy is complicit and that the labor that we do at home is exploited in a way that makes profit off of war and colonialism overseas. You know, if you take the BDS boycott, divestment, sanctions, and you think of it in terms of blockade, disrupt, strike, the working class in that sense has more power, right? Because the working class actually doesn't have money invested directly on a large scale in the Zionist project. We can do pinpointed boycotts of Israeli products, but that's not as impactful as the ways in which the points of production and economic hubs in our respective economies create profit in a global neoliberal network for the war machine, right? And so along the way, there was also a lot of political education that took place. For instance, as each city joined in the call for A15, the A15 Actions Instagram would put up a caption about the local movements in those cities. And so, for instance, from Seoul, Korea, people learned that the corporation in Seoul, Korea, that actually builds the construction equipment and the bulldozers and the cats that are used to bulldoze Palestinian homes by the Zionist project, right? And so each city was kind of able to say, this is how our own economy is complicit in the genocide and in the occupation. And this is the ways that we resist. And these are the problems that we face. And so at the same time, there was a lot of amazing learning that was going on together with the support of one another through the cities. And so again, A15 was not organized by any formal organization, any NGO, anything like this. It was organized city by city so that there was an understanding of, okay, Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam, has this background to their struggle. You know, Leeds, UK has this background. Zurich, Long Beach, Cincinnati. There was a lot of connecting in the context of different locations' struggle that all came together to disrupt economic hubs. And as you said, three international airports were blockaded, you know, for about, you know, 3 or 4 hours each. Nearly a dozen ports were impacted by various actions around the world, 20 factories, and utterly innumerable commercial highways. And so we found that at once, geographically, each city has its own kind of situated struggle. What actually connected us was the global economy in the terms in which it we are all exploited in our different locations for a system that profits off of war and colonialism.
Amazing. Yeah. I love that you, the new version of BDS that you listed, blockade, disrupt, strike, that is brilliant. And I love it. And it's so important to highlight that, you know, the working class, they don't have that money to boycott, divest, sanction, for that to be as effective as it could be, unless everyone is doing it. And, you know, we all pull our money out. It's hard for that to have a massive impact. But for individuals who are in the working class, who want to disrupt and use direct action, few people can shut down a highway. Just a handful of people can do this stuff. And it actually materially affects the economy that is profiting off of this genocide. So I love that this pivot from the symbolic to the material, to the direct, to the very targeted shutdown of different economic hubs. That is such a brilliant pivot away from all of the symbolic action that has been going on a lot and that people are just losing hope in, losing faith in. So this was so desperately needed by so many people. And when I saw that day when it started to pop off, and you know, it starts in Australia, all of a sudden I felt like, oh my God, there is this new path forward where a few people around the world can actually make a difference when it comes to this genocide. And it was just so beautiful. So, and I also just wanted to like highlight another thing that you were talking about, the combination of autonomy and solidarity. And I think that's such a beautiful combination that people should take inspiration from moving forward with other movements, because state power is very, very good at coming down hard on people who are organized into, you know, specific organizations that are doing actions. But if you are decentralized, if you are acting autonomously, and you are still supporting each other and being and you know, having agreements where you can act in solidarity and support each other in that way, it's just a beautiful way to be able to do this action while being able to kind of protect the people involved, I think. Is that an accurate representation of why that's so important?
I guess what should be said is that A15 assumed that we didn't have to change anyone's minds about Palestine, simply that there was a need to provide a structure for new models of organizing. And that hypothesis proved correct. It was one of the central departures from the organizing that had happened beforehand, before A15. And the new model for organizing was under the premise of combining solidarity with autonomy, of creating affinity rather than ownership, and building supportive connections through a basis of solidarity agreements rather than just putting out calls to action and hoping that people answered. So the focus on symbolic actions, I think, looking back in retrospect, was based on the idea of winning hearts and minds. But A15 was successful because of the correct and proven hypothesis that there already was and is mass and global support for Palestine. It was a different sort of decentralized autonomous action because there were not only agreements to keep each other safe from the state, but agreements that we would that people would be very, very principled in their organizing and to provide a space for internal critiques. It worked, you know. Even the fact that people were so ready to move beyond symbolic actions and to move without the organization of formal organizations or NGOs, in of itself is a threat to the Zionist project. If the global economy is going to coordinate to destroy Gaza, to give cover to the Zionist project, then at this point, they know that the grassroots movement against colonialism and for a free Palestine is also ready to organize.
I love that. That's beautiful. You know, I was wondering, do you think you could say a little bit more about like some of the actions that actually took place on April 15th?
Sure. In Athens, Greece, people went out and blockaded the entrance into their maritime port there. And of course, Greece has been used as a logistical hub for NATO for a long time. In Shannon, Ireland, where there's an international airport, as well as in Seattle and as well as in Chicago, those international airports experienced blockades on the roads into those airports. To my knowledge, Australia very, very much targeted factories. And across the U.S., there were shutdowns of bridges, of interstates, of different sorts of factories that are complicit in the genocide. For those who are watching the A15 Instagram page, starting on the 14th, April 14th in the U.S., was when Australia woke up and began their blockades. And then the comrades in Taiwan and Seoul and Vietnam woke up and started their actions. And then as the Americans went to sleep, Europe began doing blockades from the ports to highways to factories across Europe. And that all went on the A15 Instagram. And then, of course, the East Coast of the United States woke up, the Midwest, and then California. So it began with Australia, went all the way around the globe as the sun rises, and ended on the West Coast. And so I heard a lot of stories of people just watching all these actions pop up as the sun rose across the globe. And it was just action after action after action, just watching the Instagram and crying. But for example, in Oakland, California, the region's largest commercial highway, which is Interstate 880, that goes between the Oakland port, which is the fifth largest port in the United States, and the airport, a major hub of trucks and commercial goods and commodities, a group showed up on northbound 880 and locked themselves to barrels of concrete with rebar thrown in that, according to the news reports, that were 280 pounds each. and they locked down in a line to these barrels across northbound 880. And about an hour later, a publicly called action marched on southbound 880. 880 is a beast of a highway. And so 880 was completely shut down, and its proximity to the port meant that without even marching on the port of Oakland was shut down. Nobody was able to go to work. And actions of this type took place in 82 cities. So it's really, really hard to give a real rundown. Montreal had action on their port. You know, some cities that targeted their ports did so for the first time ever. So it was also kind of, you know, a learning experience for some cities of, wait, you know, what are the points of production here? Where in our local economies is the global economy really boosted? And so it was complete disruption and chaos. You know, Australia had, I believe, 10 locations in Australia were involved in blockades. And I know that leading up to A15, Australian media and the state really freaked out about it. And we're very prepared that there's going to be major disruptions that they just didn't know where. So yeah, with that many, with 81 cities and, or sorry, 82 cities and 19 countries, it's hard to go down the whole list of everything that happened. But if anyone's interested, you can go to A15 Actions on Instagram and scroll back and see everything that happened within those 24 hours. And then, of course, the Columbia encampment started on the 16th. No Tech for Apartheid started on the 16th. You know, the escalation began with A15.
Yeah, that blew my mind. I have been I've been barely sleeping since A15, really. I did not sleep at all the night of, as things were happening in Australia, as everything kept popping off. I was just so in awe and so glued to my phone, looking at every single development, every single country. And just, yeah, I was like near tears, elated, just so, I'd never seen anything like that in my whole life. And it was so exciting, especially knowing that people are suddenly realizing all of these economic hubs, they're understanding these important points within their economies that are crucial and that can be acted upon. So that was just such an inspiring, amazing thing. I was wondering if, can you share anything about like the lead up to the proposal for A15?
The situation in Gaza became so unbearable. I mean, it has been unbearable. 75 years of occupation is unbearable. But I think that Gaza became, you know, became the final straw. I think for people in the U.S., when Aaron Bushnell self-immolated in front of the Zionist embassy in D.C. and died as a result, after there had been so many mostly symbolic actions in the U.S., it seemed like, really, are these the choices that the movement has given to each other and to people, between symbolic actions where there's a frustration that you're not materially impacting the war machine that is the global economy, and self-immolation, that, you know, those shouldn't be the only two choices. And again, as more and more bills were passed to send money over to the Zionist project, and as Yemen was bombed, it was kind of a way of undermining the justification for the bombing of Yemen as well, which was clearly the U.S. saying, you know what we care about? We care about global trade. And so, especially for the folks who went to the ports on A15 and did actions at the ports, it was kind of like a way of saying, are you going to bomb us in West Oakland? Are you going to bomb us in Athens, Greece? Are you going to bomb us in Vancouver? Are you going to bomb us in Montreal? So it's almost like the state spelled out for the movement what it really cares about, which is the wheels of production. And that's why people were very ready across the world to blockade arteries of capitalism and jam the wheels of production.
Incredible.
A15 was certainly a historic action. There were folks from the West Bank and folks from Gaza that were writing in saying that they were in tears to see something spread so quickly and so simultaneously across the globe. Especially for our Palestinian comrades, you know, you're organizing through pain. And there was a great, great need to really stop and listen to the pain in which people were feeling at the same time that they were putting so much work in organizing. I think every movement grapples with the ways in which gendered and racialized capitalist division of labor is reproduced in the struggles against those very same exploitative structures. Every organizing effort should directly tackle the ways in which invisibilized, feminized, non-celebrated work often falls on women, BIPOC people, the people who capitalism already relegates invisibilized but super crucial labor to. You know, while A15 actions took place horizontally, autonomous and horizontal structures don't create immunity per se from needing to really self-consciously build rigorous feminist and anti-racist analysis and practices. And so when conversations about how to integrate a feminist and anti-racist practice aren't consistently taking place, it ends up being that lots of difficult, overlooked, and sleepless background and support work falls on marginalized groups whose labor is already exploited in capitalism along the same lines. So, you know, to really build feminist and anti-racist political formations, we need to always be looking at how organizing labor falls across gendered and racialized lines and whether or not our own movements are reproducing the systems that we hate, or whether our movements are actively rebelling against them. And I think a beautiful thing about A15 was that at the very least, there was a serious and self-conscious effort to directly confront and grapple with these questions.
Mm-hmm. And that's so crucial to the folks that are getting out there and putting, you know, risking arrest and everything. They need the support from other folks who are doing the background work. And that is always going to be an important component of these kinds of actions. So I'm glad that you brought up that point. You were talking about how crucial it is to be organizing with Palestinian comrades who are dealing with so much pain right now, who are being directly affected by the genocide in Gaza, many of whom have lost countless family members and are just going through hell while trying to stand up and make a difference here. I was wondering if you had anything else you want to share about doing that kind of work in solidarity with Palestinian comrades.
Yeah, I think, again, as A15 stated in the solidarity agreements, that solidarity is affinity, not ownership. And building affinity really means understanding and listening to people's pain. And that kind of like care labor and listening and supporting is often delegated to women or feminized people, but it's something that the whole movement needs to be able to hold without falling into the NGO framework of ownership over certain identities. Because certainly, like, you know, most of the Palestinians that were organizing during A15 were not, you know, represented by NGOs and large formal organizations that kind of take ownership over folks' identities. The same with JVP. I'm an anti-Zionist Jew. I'm not a member of JVP. When we say affinity, that solidarity means affinity, we need to think beyond affinity in terms of not talking to the police, for example, or in terms of jail support. But we also need to think about affinity in terms of deeply understanding the pain and the fatigue and the devastation of folks who are impacted in different ways. And at the same time, I think A15 really took its inspiration from Palestinian resilience and from Palestinian resistance and attempted to like build a movement that demonstrates that same kind of resilience based on struggle and affinity.
Amazing. Yeah. I'm so glad that you pivoted to talking about the inspiration from the Palestinian struggle, because too often Palestinians right now are painted as recipients of what is happening, the passive recipients of all of the shit that is happening right now, when in reality, the incredible resistance of the Palestinian people, in spite of the fact that they are up against armored vehicles, one of the most heavily militarized regimes in the world with nuclear weapons and the U.S. support, they are still able to organize, stand up, fight back. And that kind of beautiful resilience, that kind of beautiful resistance is so inspiring. So while we're acknowledging the suffering and trying to be there for our Palestinian comrades in that way, I think it's also so important to shine light on the fact that Palestinians are the ones who are inspiring all of us. You know, they are the ones, they are the agents of their own futures and their own change. And the actions that are spiraling outside of Gaza are in large part because of the resilience that we've seen within Gaza. And so I'm just really glad that you brought up the inspiration of from the Palestinian struggle. That's so beautiful.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for the comrades in Australia who've been organizing with Aboriginal struggles there for a long time, certainly there were many Indigenous North American folks who were organizing during A15. And also there was a lot of affinity from Indigenous person to Indigenous person across the world and learning a lot about other Indigenous struggles. So yeah, I think that was an important aspect as well.
Absolutely. I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about the scale of the financial impact. Do you have a sense for the effect of these targeted actions in terms of dollar amounts?
Yeah, I think that's difficult. I mean, if you think that the port of Oakland, you know, that has hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars of production and or profit making a day was shut down by default because of the shutdown of the 880 commercial highway. And you think about the port actions around the world and the actions at the factories, it seems to have been millions, if not billions of dollars that were lost. But of course, you know, the capitalist class will never admit to the, you know, that kind of a defeat. Not only did it cost a lot of money to the capitalist class and that profits off of war and colonialism. But it also demonstrated that people can be in solidarity with each other around the world, that there is a global movement, and as well that, you know, that people were ready to escalate. Aside from the estimated dollar loss, I think a threat to the Zionist project was in fact the geographical scale, the participation of so many diverse groups of people from Seoul, Korea to various countries in Europe, all over North America, all over Australia, that we are not disconnected. We are connected in our struggles and in our affinity, and have the ability to do simultaneous actions with each other. And so even if there was not such a large scale of dollar loss as it seems that there was, demonstrating a coordinated effort around the world in of itself is a threat to the Zionist project and a sign that the movement is learning, and the movement is learning quickly. You know, sometimes in broad social movements,
the kind of learning that would otherwise take place over years takes place over weeks or months, you know? And so we've seen that in the shift of attitudes towards the Zionist project, towards the complicity of the US. And we've seen that in the shift of attitudes towards escalation and material blockades rather, and, you know, that then bled into the students across the US resisting the police rather than symbolic actions and fear. So there was possibly billions of dollars of profit loss on A-15 during the economic blockade. But I think as well, what people lost was fear. And what they gained is a sense that none of our struggles, none of us, you know, are alone. You know, 82 cities came out in support of Palestine, but also in support of each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just, you know, the economic power that was leveraged here, but the people power that was leveraged, the sheer number of people who were willing to risk so much to do these actions. And that is just like, my mind was fucking blown to watch all of that, to watch so many people being willing to do this. Because I've engaged in direct action before. I've done lockdowns, I've done hunger strikes, I've, you know, sit-ins, things like that. And, you know, I never in back in those days did I think I was going to witness something like this to this scale. And so it's just, yeah, it gives me so much hope to see so many people from so many countries standing up and saying, no, we're not going to fucking take this anymore. This is an untenable status quo. And it is, we are going to shut this shit down. Like it is, yeah, the most inspiring thing that I've seen in so fucking long. So,
yeah, it's really hard, like, to, you know, 82 cities, 19 countries, 6 continents, but when you all in one day, all adhering to these solidarity agreements, all adhering to this proposal for economic blockades, it's hard to fathom, but it's real. The only thing that I can compare it to historically, I mean, really the civil rights movement was won through coordinated economic boycotts, pinpointed economic boycotts. And of course, those folks were organizing without cell phones, without the internet, and, you know, in a smaller geographical area, traveling around by buses to organize pinpointed economic boycotts. And during Occupy in the U.S., there was a coordinated West Coast port shutdown in which the Occupy movement up and down the West Coast of the United States coordinated to shut down the ports on the West Coast in response to the state coordinating evictions of the Occupy encampments. And when the West Coast port shutdown happened, you know, it was, you know, a handful to several ports on the West Coast of the United States. That in of itself caused a backlog of maritime commercial traffic that was impacted weeks later, even in Asia. So yeah, the scale is remarkable. But it also demonstrates the scale of pain. But, you know, as was said in A-15, the pain of the Palestinians is our rage. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it also, A-15 also happened in an extremely healthy way. There was no sectarianism during or after. There was no nasty stuff written on the internet about one city or another. The movement really came together and said, look, we can be principled and we can coordinate and do action simultaneously. And we can adhere to solidarity agreements and really have each other's backs. Any advancement in the movement and learning along the way, especially on that scale again, and learning from each other's struggles, I also have not seen anything like it. So I agree. It's hard to imagine, but it's also like hard to imagine that the Zionist project actually thinks that they can go as far as they can go without a mass global response. And that mass global response arrived on A-15, and it continues through the proliferation of the student encampments, which are now spreading in other countries as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if you want to talk about the encampments and how they might have been inspired by A15, or if that's even something that you can talk about.
Like within our lifetime, in New York put out a communique that said a spark can cause a prairie fire, and that A15 did inspire the escalation on the college campuses. It's totally possible. In 1968, folks were inspired by seeing movements in different places. Of course, 68 was not like A15 because it was spontaneous. Yeah. Who knows? You know, sometimes folks are just waiting for other, you know, other people to kind of like step up. And I think people were really frustrated in the United States by call outs to shut things down that didn't materialize in something that felt tangible. And I think when people see things done with a lot of solidarity and a lot of determination and a lot of careful thought put into it, there's a response.
Yes, truly. It seems like a lot of the students, they've been inspired by each other, but it's all kicked off right after A15, like 2 days after A15 at Columbia, and then all of these other campuses followed suit. And that tells me that people were so hungry for a different kind of approach that made more tangible change, that really had an actual impact. And so as soon as they saw people actually doing that, they were ready to step up and follow suit, do the exact same. And yeah, I mean, the scale of this, the college campus protests right now, of the encampments and the occupations, is also just remarkable and blowing my fucking mind. I have not slept these past 2 weeks because this shit is just so historic. It gives me so much hope for the future. And all of a sudden, you know, I think people around this country are feeling like, okay, we aren't just passive observers of everything that's happening in Gaza. We can actually do something right now. I'm so thankful to the folks who were involved in stepping up on A15 for maybe helping to start that kind of chain reaction there, even though it was all decentralized and autonomous.
Again, A15 is affinity, not ownership. So it's hard to say A15 started this. But A15, you know, did call for extensions of actions should there be police repression on A15. And there, you know, there was police repression. And in total, there was 482 arrests approximately, which considering the scale of actions is very low. But, you know, people in Montreal were tear gassed. Like in Australia, you know, there was police repression. There was a lot of feedback from people all over the world, actually, leading up to A15, asking, you know, how can I get involved? Like, this is exactly what needs to happen and stuff like that. So, yeah, I think A15 is certainly like there's a lot of overlap between the people involved in encampments and the people who threw down on A15 were also students, a lot of different community members. Without giving credit to A15, I think we can say that there was a lot of affinity that was built in the lead up to A15, as well as the spirit of a need to escalation, especially after the flower massacre, with the threat of the invasion into Rafah. And also with, you know, just the building of communities speaking to each other across like a geographical divides.
You brought up the 482 arrests, and I thought, you know, it might be a good time to talk about some of the response from the state. When we had talked before, you mentioned that Homeland Security and military think tanks had a lot to say about the global economic blockade, and that they were impressed by this new threat. I was just wondering if you had anything more that you wanted to say about that.
I think it's possible the state was caught off guard by A15. You know, when movements are consistent and build momentum and actions are just constantly following one another and popping off, it can be hard for the state to catch up. When we keep each other safe by sticking to solidarity agreements, such as not talking to the police, and also just by not spreading unprincipled rumors or gossip or character assassinations, but instead rather build trust and affinity by keeping critiques internal and productive. I think that also makes it more difficult for the state to figure out how to break up a movement. And A15 demonstrated a serious and deliberate and thoughtful effort at what could be best practices for the health of the movement and for the health of comrades that participated. And, you know, like, look, the state hugely underestimated the students and the student movement. And the state made a really big mistake in repressing the encampments with arrests and violence, because that caused more rage. It caused more students to come out, more community members to come out, more encampments to be built, more people to organize. Sometimes when the state makes mistakes and overreaches in its repression, more people come out into the streets, and the movement needs to recognize when the state makes those kinds of mistakes in order to react and grow and provide solidarity and structures for folks who come out in response to that kind of state repression.
Yeah. And the NYPD being called on students was definitely a really, really horrible mistake. And after that, so many more people realized that the worst has kind of already happened and we are ready to step up.
Sometimes the issue with spontaneous movements rather than kind of coordinated movements is, how do we continue that sense of affinity and solidarity and having each other's backs and escalating at the same time? So, you know, it's something to think about. Every movement is pedagogical in a sense, and recognizing our mistakes and what we could have done better is also something that, you know, that's necessary to think about as we go along. You know, certainly very much listening to one another and seeing what struggles are like in different places, which, again, like, if anyone is interested, I think, and you really want to scroll through the A15 Instagram, there is a lot of political education on the A15 Actions Instagram page about different struggles in different cities that participated in A15. And by having knowledge and of each other and listening to each other, there's a lot to be learned rather than always just being in our internal problems and whatever political struggle we're in locally.
Definitely. I was kind of amazed to hear in some of the coverage that I was following by more mainstream media outlets, they would talk about, like, you know, oh, do these people on this highway, you know what cause they're even protesting? And some of them, you know, some of the reporters were saying, like, no, there's not a lot of signs. There's not a lot of, like, it's not made very obvious to people why this shutdown is happening. Do you know if that was a deliberate strategy to not alienate people, or was that, like, yeah, do you have anything that you'd want to share about that?
That's just the Zionist media lying.
Okay.
I think that, you know, we experience again and again that the media infantilizes protesters the same way that, you know, the mainstream narrative infantilizes women and people of color as not really, like, having a cause or knowing why they're doing what they're doing. But certainly there is signage across the world. You know, the global economy is complicit in genocide and occupation, and you know, we are taking collective risk to free Palestine, and, you know, Palestinian flags. And yeah, there was certainly a lot of signage. I think the social media pages, like dealing with shadow banning and stuff like that, I think that, you know,
people have also really like woken up to, you know, with everything that's going went on with the New York Times, where they had a style guide that said that you can only use the word Palestine in like certain situations, that really the, you know, the media is only willing to replicate, you know, Zionist narratives. And, you know, Zionist narratives are like every other colonialist narrative is based on Orientalism. You know, this racist idea that Arabs, you know, are disorganized and, you know, weak and lack strength and stuff like that. So, yeah, there was there's nothing deliberate that I know of on the part of any of the cities in A15 about their signage. Everyone chose their own signage. But, you know, the media is certainly quick to pretend that, you know, protesters don't know what they're doing. It's the same way where people are calling the students in the encampment kids. I mean, these are not kids, they're adults. You know, they talk to each other, they educate each other just as well as, you know, any formalized education, and they certainly know what they're doing.
Yeah, and the students that I've spoken with on this show, divesting their student government funds from apartheid Israel, they were some of the most eloquent human beings I've ever connected with, and I was like blown the fuck away by them. So yeah, all of this infantilizing talk about the people who are involved in this stuff is complete bullshit. Everyone who I've connected with who is deeply involved is so principled, is so smart. You know, it's remarkable. It's really, I've been so inspired by everyone that I've connected with.
You know, as a Jewish person, it's extremely anti-Semitic and of the media to repeat these Zionist lies that Palestinian protests put Jewish students or Jews in danger, when in fact Zionism co-opted Jewish identity for a colonialist project. And Zionism is also based on the erasure of the rich history of Jews on the left, especially in Europe, especially for young secular urban Jews in the interwar period, where being a communist or being an anarchist was the most compelling way to be Jewish. And so, you know, to see the media as well erasing Jewish identity and homogenizing it only into an affinity with a nationalist, colonialist, genocidal project, for me is completely anti-Semitic and insulting. That propaganda that Jews are one thing and only support Israel and therefore are in danger from Palestinian protests in the name of somehow speaking on anti-Semitism is remarkable. But I think as well that people know that in this movement, there has been overwhelming like Palestinian and Jewish solidarity in the streets, and that Jews under 40 at this point don't support the Zionist project, and the veil has fallen, and don't support the co-optation of our name and the erasure of our history on the left for occupation and genocide.
So watching on YouTube some of the content that's being put out and on social media, a video was shared saying that escalation has only just begun. And I was wondering if you could share anything about what might be happening in the future.
A15 cities have demonstrated, you know, to let the Freedom Flotilla sail and have committed to having their eyes on what happens with the Freedom Flotilla to Gaza. But I think that A15 demonstrated a certain level of commitment to the freedom of Palestine. And that commitment was demonstrated in 82 cities and 19 countries across 6 continents. And so whatever the future holds will clearly reflect that wide-scale, historic, global commitment to ending the destruction of Gaza, the occupation, and to the freedom of Palestinians in their land.
Amazing. And I will be following and watching very closely as everything goes down in the coming months and weeks. So before we tie up this conversation here, I kind of wanted to get back to the cocktail, which is kind of, it sounds ridiculous, but before we actually had this conversation, we talked before about how complex it is to be navigating wanting to celebrate the successes of A15 while also simultaneously acknowledging the seriousness and the horrors of what is happening in Gaza to the Palestinian people, and how complex that is, while so many of the people who are organizing and involved in these protests are Muslim and thus do not drink. So this is, you know, we wanted to acknowledge that that is like a complex, weird thing, while also saying that, yes, we want to celebrate and recognize the fact that A15 was a historic victory for the movement for Palestinian liberation. So I wanted to just bring that up, see if you had anything to say about how kind of navigating that complexity here.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think a lot of friendships, like any movement, friendships were forged through A15, and even through pain, there's laughter. Like, Palestinians teach life. Palestinians mm-hmm. teach life. And I think that if we can only hold each other in laughter, we can't hold each other in pain. And if being able to like laugh and have fun with each other is also a way of holding each other through pain. I think it's about friendship and affinity. So of course there's been a lot of joy that, you know, A15 was successful and that we had, you know, that people had each other's backs. And I don't think that that has diminished the pain through which people are organizing, because I think, you know, people are complex and can feel various things at once. And that's what solidarity and friendship is about, is holding all the complexities, you know, and joy and pain.
Yeah, and I think that this is so important when we're talking about trying to organize in solidarity with Palestine and trying to navigate the suffering and the joy and really experience the solidarity. That is one of the reasons why I love cocktails. You know, we can kind of like take down some of our walls and our defenses and relax and be together. That is one reason why I love this component of the show. But yeah, I thought I would share a little bit more about how the cocktail is made. So the A15 Intifada cocktail is made with 30 milliliters of mezcal, amazing smoky flavor there, 30 milliliters of Campari or some kind of red aperitivo, 30 milliliters of red Italian style vermouth, 2 dashes of bitters, and chocolate bitters work really well here to kind of bring the flavors together. And then 2 slices of jalapeno, 1 for muddling with the mezcal before you mix the drink, and then 1 for garnishing at the end so that you have a beautiful red drink with a green garnish. And I used a whole jalapeno to garnish my drink, so it looks really cool. But yeah, I wanted to bring this up again also because like, I thought that did a really brilliant job of suggesting a drink that is both like smoky, kind of representing the fiery element of A15 and these actions, with a drink that is also spicy and has the red and green of Palestine. So it is just like the perfect thing to kind of enjoy some solidarity together with our comrades who are fighting for Palestinian liberation hand in hand. I wish there was a mocktail version of this one, but this one's a hard one to make as a mocktail because it's all alcohol. So
the mocktail is a watermelon.
Yes. And we do have the Free Palestine cocktail, which is either alcoholic or spirit free. So yeah, folks can go check that out from our 3 episodes on the history of Palestine. But yeah, so I wanted to just open up the floor here for you to give any kind of plugs or calls to action for folks who want to get involved or help in any way.
Certainly. A15 actions on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, although mostly on Instagram. Boosts up, you know, communiques from the encampments and calls for support from the encampments, as well as continuing to boost actions from A15 cities around the world, cities that participated in A15. It should be said that people across the United States, at least received, might have been cited and released, but are waiting for charges to be pressed against them. And A15 will certainly put out calls to with district attorneys' numbers to ask that those charges be dropped, should charges be bought. There's an A15 only bail fund link on the website. The website is a15action.com, as A15 also looks towards supporting people who might have had their cars impounded or received other kinds of like fines or fees around the country. And as well, you know, the A15 resources, such as the solidarity agreements, the initial proposal, and the wrap-up video, is available in many, many different languages, so that we can move away from a kind of like English colonialist language-based movement culture into one that is more inclusive of what has become a global solidarity movement. So continue to follow A15 Actions on social media and A15Action.com on the website.
Perfect. That's great. And I did write down that if you want to support the A15 arrestees in the United States, there's a link at bit.ly/A15fund. So you can go check that out, and I'll try to include some links in the show notes. But I just want to say thank you so, so much for being willing to come and speak with me about this. I know that it's a very sensitive and, you know, difficult topic to tackle and air publicly. So I appreciate you so much being willing to help me tell the story and to do it with so much grace and intention about all of the different components that were involved. Thank you so much for being willing to speak with me and for taking the time. It's really an honor.
Oh, thank you for the solidarity. And to everyone listening, may we all be in solidarity with each other moving forward.
Hell yeah. I love that so much. Well, and to that I say cheers and solidarity. Thank you so much for tuning into this anti-capitalist project. To remain independent and free from the corrupting influence of corporations, Cocktails and Capitalism has rejected the corporate advertising model. Instead, we've decided that the only ethical approach to funding our work is through the kind support of listeners like you and revolutionary groups that embody our values. This show was sponsored by Beautiful Trouble, an international network of organizers, artists, and trainers working to equip grassroots movements with the tools to become more creative, effective, and irresistible. If you value the work that we're doing here at Cocktails and Capitalism, we would deeply appreciate any amount you're able to contribute through Patreon, even if it's only a dollar a month. This project involves a massive amount of research, networking, content creation, and editing, all of which has been done by myself and a small team of volunteers. None of us have been paid for our time and labor, but I hope to make this work more financially sustainable in the future. You can lend a hand by signing up on Patreon or by purchasing merch through my friend's shop, Punk with a Camera, which I've linked in the show notes. For those of you who are unable to contribute financially, which is totally understandable in this fucked up economy, you can still support the show by giving us a rating and writing a review on Apple and Spotify. Doing this would really help to increase our visibility. This anti-capitalist project is still quite small, so telling your friends about it can actually make a significant difference. Please follow us on Instagram, where I'm most active, as well as Threads, TikTok, and Twitter. That's right, fuck you, Elon. As those of you who are following already know, suppression of the kind of content we talk about on the show is rampant on social media. By engaging with and sharing our posts, you can help to counter this repression while inviting others to learn about the current anti-capitalist struggles for social and environmental justice. Big thanks to John, our producer and audio editor, Jesse Torres, our resident anti-capitalist bartender, Dredd, our video editor, and Anthony, who's been helping me with social media. To all of our existing patrons, thank you so goddamn much. Your support truly helps to keep this anti-capitalist independent media project alive. Much love to you all. Cheers and solidarity forever.